I had thought about death and the decomposition of all the particles in my body many times, to the extent that it didn't frighten me. In fact, my true wish was to be completely annihilated. The only thing that frightened me was that the atoms in my body would mix with the atoms in the bodies of the vulgar. This was an insufferable thought. Sometimes I wished that after death I would have long arms and extended fingers with which I could gather all my own atoms and hold them with both hands so that the atoms that belonged to me would not enter the bodies of the vulgar.
Holy, oh, holy.
Welcome once again to the Spouter Inn. I'm Chris.
And I'm Suzanne.
And this time we are looking at Sadek Hayat's Blind Owl.
Yeah, this is a book very different from books we read before, I thought.
Yeah, I had forgotten until after I read the book, but before I edited our previous episode, that you had warned me that it was a creepy book, that it was a bit of an unsettling book. I just thought it was going to be about a nice owl.
Because with the first book that we read every year, we try to look for something that we haven't thought about before, sort of adding something to the mix that is just not on the table already. And this book I thought would be an interesting choice, both because it would allow us to think about Persian literature, literature from modern Iran, something we hadn't thought about for quite a while, I think, since we did Persepolis. But also, it would connect with some of the themes of modernism that we've been talking about. So I thought it would be both a kind of have some continuity with works we'd read already, but also take us in a good direction.
Yeah, this book is from 1936, and it seems to, you know, be in play with some of the other predecessors of modernism that some of the books that we looked at last year were also aware of or thinking with.
Yeah. Are there some books that we've read together that this reminded you of, or that, like, you felt like you were having moments of, or that it was connecting to? I felt a few of those.
In a very curious way, it reminded me the most of Invisible Man. And this was partially because, as is the usual way I do these, I was listening to the audiobook while reading it, and it's not read by the same person, but their voices were fairly similar. So I kept having echoes of that, as well as some of the cadences of some of the sentences. And also, you know, it reminded me of some of those more hallucinogenic, paranoid passages in Invisible Man, and that sense of, is this really happening or is this not really happening?
Mm-hmm. I can totally see that. It didn't occur to me when I was reading, but I can totally see that. I found myself thinking about books I'd read where there was kind of an element of the disturbing or the abject or the horrible. When I was young, I read a lot of Poe, Edgar Allan Poe, which I really enjoyed. And it was really connected for me, reading this, connected to some of those moments of reading. And also reading Kafka. And so it was really interesting to get a little sense of the writer, Sadek Hayat, and get a sense of where he maybe saw himself in terms of literary traditions.
Yeah, and that makes a lot of sense. And we have not done either Poe or Kafka on this show yet, because we have so many writers to do.
Someday.
But yeah, someday.
I thought Poe would be great to do. We should definitely do him next. Well, if not next year, maybe the year after, at some point.
Someday.
Should I say a little bit about Hayat?
Yeah, please do.
So Sadek Hayat, born in 1903, died in 1951, was a writer and a translator. And he was born in Iran, northern Iran, grew up in Tehran, part of an aristocratic family, which I mention mostly because it means he had sort of government connections of different sorts in his family, as well as in the army. And there were kind of complications for him that grew politically out of that web of relations that he came out of and the political positions he himself was taking. He was educated in French language schools in Iran and then went to Europe for studies in 1925 when he was a young man in his early 20s. Originally, he went to go study engineering in Belgium, and then he went to go study architecture, clearly being a good boy. But, you know, the wiles of France, I think, probably got to him. He got deeply interested in literature, and again, especially modernist literature. After 4 years in France, he went back to Iran without finishing his degree, but he took back the sort of knowledge base he'd accumulated. And as you said already, he was clearly really interested in European writers of different sorts. So I've mentioned Poe and Kafka. He's also said to have been interested in the poet Rilke, de Maupassant, Chekhov, Gogol, you know, a whole range of European writers. But he was also deeply, deeply interested in Iranian language, history, and culture. And that plays out in a number of different ways. He spent a period of time really immersing himself in histories of Zoroastrianism, so pre-Islamic Iran, and getting an understanding of the sort of connectivities of Iran and the region, including South Asia. He also learned Pahlavi, which is sort of old Persian language, and wrote and did some translations from that. So it's neat that he's somebody who's got his tendrils deeply woven into the European literary scene, but also into the Iranian literary and cultural scene. He published a whole bunch of short stories and short novels, also plays, literary criticism, and so on. And Blind Owl, or Boufakour, is his most famous work. He started writing it probably when he was still in France in the late 1920s. He finished writing it in 1936, but it wasn't published in the usual conventional kind of way. Originally, it was published in Mumbai in 1937, while he was in South Asia for about 2 years, in a limited edition. And so this is a very small edition of 50 copies, mimeographed, right, because there was not photocopying, right, mimeographed from his handwritten manuscript. So it's quite a specific individual authorial hand production. It wasn't published in Iran, but a little later, after the political situation had changed, after Reza Shah had abdicated, it was serialized in a periodical and had some impact, as I understand, in that time. The work was later banned, though, in Iran, and as far as I know, it's still not openly published in Iran, to the best of my knowledge, but it has been translated widely. There are translations in Armenian, Dutch, English, French, Filipino, Finnish, German, Indonesian, Japanese, Malay, Polish, Romanian, Spanish, Turkish, and Urdu. So it's all over. But it'd be interesting to know more about the lives that it's had in these different literary histories. He returned to Paris in 1950, where he died the following year in 1951 by suicide. And I mention that because the sort of aura of the book, for good or for ill, is bound up a little bit in the kind of persona and the almost legend of the author. So it's interesting to think about how those two things folded together. And the book, I must say, really lives up to the drama of the life. It's a short book, but a very, very like dense one emotionally dense and heavy, I think. Did you have that feeling too?
I did. It's very dreamy. It's very unsure. It's very pleasantly confusing, I would say. You never get confused moment to moment, but it can be very tricky to figure out where you are big picture. It's not stable in that sense, and it achieves that in a lot of interesting ways, which I think we'll get into.
Do you want to say a little bit more about the plot, which is, as you say, easy to hold on to moment, but really hard to hold on to in the aggregate?
I do, but I want to, before I start the plot, I want to say it's a short book. It's very readable, especially in the translation that we read, which was a translation by Sasan Tabatabai. So talking about the book is necessarily going to involve spoilers, and it might be a book that you might enjoy reading first, you know, spoiler-free, although I don't think we're going to ruin it if we talk about spoilers. So is there anything else you want to say to people who might be leaving that would encourage them to read the book before they go?
Yeah, it's a book that I think it's a very kind of emotional read. I remember when I first looked at it, I was really intrigued and drawn in. And then when I started to read it again a little bit more systematically, I was like, oh, is this too much? Is it kind of overwhelming? And then as I read it again, I was just fascinated by the kind of, I don't know, the labyrinthine, puzzly quality of it. So if you like Borges, if you like I said, if you like Poe, if you like those kinds of writers that kind of pull you into a world and it's very disorienting and kind of hypnotic, but then you have the satisfaction of a kind of almost puzzle-like resolution, then you're going to enjoy this a lot. And you should then, you know, stop listening, go read it, and come back.
Exactly. Well, if you choose to do that, we'll see you in a few hours. We should say, however, content warning both for the book and for this episode, which mentions some potentially disturbing imagery. But for those of you who are sticking around, either because you already read it or because you are not afraid of spoilers, welcome. So I'd like to ask all of you to imagine a pen case cover that's been painted with a scene, an elaborate scene, an old man sitting beneath a cypress tree, hunched over, wearing a turban, holding a finger to his lips in surprise. And then in front of him, an angelic young woman in a long black dress, offering him a purple water lily, and between them, a stream. So the narrator of this book is a pen case painter who spends his days painting this exact scene over and over again on endless pen cases. Or he has been seeing this scene, or parts of the scene, over and over again in his life. Certainly a woman very much like the woman in the painting has been haunting him. He's obsessed with her, but he hasn't seen her for 2 months and 4 days. He drinks, smokes some opium, and now suddenly finds she's at his home, but she's dead. He takes her body to bury it, and an old man, very much like the old man in the pen case painting, offers to help. And eventually he deals with the body, goes home, and smokes some more opium. And he remembers his family life. Or his family life in another time? His wife, who's also his cousin, who has refused to give him any physical affection, which infuriates him. Is she also the woman from the pen case painting? The old man who sells odds and ends on a blanket outside his door, he's clearly the old man from the painting. And he begins to suspect his wife is sleeping with the old man. He falls sick. He takes some more opium for the pain. And he remembers his childhood, spying on his cousin, his future wife, changing clothes when they were both kids. He remembers his fascination with his wet nurse, who's also his aunt, who looks so much like her daughter, his wife. And he learns that his wife is pregnant. Who could the father be? One night, he takes a knife and goes into his wife's room, but decides that perhaps he's wrong about her. Perhaps she's not sleeping around. One night, he takes a knife and goes into his wife's room, and she thinks it's a paramour coming in. And so he gets into bed with her, and then he inadvertently stabs her. Afterwards, he looks in the mirror, and suddenly he's become old, his hair turned white. He's become the old man who sells odds and ends, the old man who sits under the cypress tree in the pen case painting. And he looks at the mirror, and he's covered in maggots, and he's dead.
You must be like, what?
That's not an exhaustive summary of everything that happens, gosh. Of course. But it gives you a bit of a sense, I suppose, of how this book sets out some plot and then sort of just changes it or upends your sense of who people are, how they relate to each other, and even some fundamentals such as when is this happening?
Yeah, it's vivid and hallucinogenic and episodic. And I think, you know, you conveyed that really well. I think one of the things I was really struck by in the translation that we read, which I like very much, which we're going to talk about more, in the introduction, the translator gives us a summary, you know, of the beautiful spoiler alert, you know, do not read this if you haven't read the book, go read the book and come back. But the summary is pretty clear and explicit. And it may then for the reader come as a little bit of a surprise of how episodic and how hallucinogenic the narrative itself is. And I thought you kind of like did a good job of splitting that difference, like giving us a sense of what happens, but being like, and this, and this, and this, because that's how the book feels when you read it.
Well, thank you for that. I found that introductory bit, which I also read after I finished the main text of the book, to be fascinating, specifically because it's such a choice to have the plot, every beat of the plot, you know, which would take longer than we have right here, to discuss what's going on. But the book does make sense in a moment-to-moment way. Like, I never felt completely lost, except if I stood back from it a little bit, it became more indistinct. Yeah, as I went, wait, how does this section that I'm reading right now relate to other sections in the book?
Well, and one of the ways it creates this effect, which I found really simultaneously orienting and disorienting, was through repetitions. You know, you mentioned objects like the pen case that the narrator is painting at the very beginning. Objects and phrases come back again and again and again. So the pen case comes back. The images that he's painting on the pen case, that scenario you described of the old man and the young woman and the lotus flower and the stream, comes back again and again. A particular gesture that someone makes early in the book, you know, gnawing on their left index finger, comes back again and again, different figures doing it. And so in a way that creates continuities through the book, but it also, it's like that's what I meant about it being kind of hallucinogenic, where it's like you've seen this thing before, but it doesn't quite make sense.
There's a really great early example of this when he's burying the body of the woman he's been obsessed with, which seems like a weird thing when you read it at the very beginning of the book and you don't yet fully have all of the elements and all of their repetitions echoing off each other, right? It's just this painter who's been obsessed who now has a corpse that he has got to deal with, and so he's going to try to bury it, and he gets the old man to help him. And there are repeated interactions with the old man that really sort of set out the table stakes as to how repetition is going to work in this book.
Yeah, because there's the old man initially in the painted image, and he mentions early on how the old man resembles his uncle and how he himself resembles his uncle and how his father resembled the uncle. So he brings that all out. But then we have the hunched old man show up again as the porter. And so it's just this weird set of continuities.
Right. And so the porter offers to help him take the corpse out to a site that might be suitable for burial. He then agrees to help dig the grave. He then agrees to take the guy back. And after each time, there are some repeated phrases. So I reached into my pocket to pay the wagoner's fare, but only had 2 kiran and 1 abasi coins. The wagoner burst into a dry and disturbing laugh and said, "Don't worry about it, okay? I will get from you later. I know your house. You don't need more, huh? I just want you to know I'm not without skill with digging graves, huh? Don't be shy. Let's go right here near river next to cypress tree. I will dig ditch for you, right size of suitcase," the suitcase in which the body is in. "Then we'll go." So they dig it, and then this is just a few paragraphs later. "I reached into my pocket to pay his fare, but only had 2 kiran and 1 abasi coins. The old man burst into a dry, disturbing laugh and said, "Not necessary. It's nothing. I know your house. Huh? And instead of my fare, I found earthen jug. It is vase from Ragas, old city of Ray." Huh? Like, we had this moment not a page ago.
Yeah.
and yet nobody is acting as if this is unusual, right?
It's like a glitch in the Matrix, right? It's happened a second time, right?
Exactly, exactly. The narrative's glitching out, and we'll do it again almost shortly thereafter. And it's a kind of introduction. This is not too far into the beginning of the book. And it's like, no, this is a thing that's going to happen in this world of the narrative, is repetitions of phrases that are going to change slightly each time are going to keep coming up, and things will keep echoing. And that is how the world is built. That is not a strange thing that you need to explain away.
Well, one of the neat things that happens too in those like double moments, and that's such a good example of them, is something new emerges too. Because the first time that passage happens, you know, they have this exchange about the coins and, you know, "Don't worry about it, I'll dig a ditch for you." And then they have the exchange about the coins again. And he says, "Instead of my fare, I found earthen jug. It's vase from Ragas, old city of Ray, huh?" And so that's when the jug appears. And the jug will turn out to be really important, because a few pages later, the narrator will have the jug and he takes it out of its cloth wrapping, wipes away the dirt, and it has a violet glaze, ancient and clear, the color of ground golden bee flies. And on one side, purple water lilies lined an almond-shaped frame. And in the middle of that was a drawing of her face, the woman with the large black eyes. So the subject of the pen case painting that he's also in the meantime reproduced as a drawing he made while the dead body was in front of him appears now on the surface of the earthen jug. So it's like these repetitions create like holes, kind of, I don't know how to put it, spaces for something new to come out that'll be a really important symbolic part of the narrative. It's really weird.
Exactly. Yeah. And we get that very early on when, you know, we've had the description of the scene on the pen case, but his uncle / father question mark arrives at his house unexpectedly, and he goes to get a bottle of wine, which we will learn later is poisoned wine. And he has a vision, sort of seeing through, what is it, a hole, a window? We don't even know. It's not there when he goes back to it later, but he sees the scene sort of outside his house as it's been depicted there. And it's like, what is going on? What is this? It's destabilizing your sense of the reality of this world.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah. And he goes back with the same wine vessel in his hand to put it back on the shelf. And he discovers that that hole or that space, that spy hole kind of that he was seeing through, he can't find it now. The wall is black.
Right.
So like, it's sort of almost like it corresponds to the way that that earthen jug functions, you know, the doubled passage, something is introduced there. Something new comes out in that doubling.
Yeah. I don't know if there's much in this book that doesn't get doubled.
Yeah, no, totally. Cause I started like trying to like map it out, and it's just dizzying. I mean, it's pairs, like it's doubles, but then it gets redoubled, almost like ripples in water or something like that. The second time I was reading, so when I was still kind of orienting myself, I was like, it almost feels in some ways like long narrative poetry, you know, as opposed to a novel. You know, when you read one of these really long narrative poems and there's a refrain or a turn of phrase that shows up again and again, that's what it felt like, I thought.
Oh, sure. Yeah. No, it's a bit like a villanelle or something, where the little phrases are meant to return at the end of certain lines, but have different contexts each time they come back. Yeah, absolutely. It is a bit like that, but it's even more totalizing.
Mm-hmm.
I think one of the other interesting forms of repetition is in the characters, because we have this all being based on this painting, or this image of the two people separated by a river. And so every character seems to end up being mapped onto either the old man or the alluring woman. You know, our narrator turns out to be the old man for certain values of to be, but is clearly meant to evoke him at certain points. The father is that. All the women seem to be replicas of this alluring woman who he has some sort of sexual desire for and repulsion from in various awkward measures. I guess, how do women get treated in this book? How should we talk about that?
Yeah, I do want to talk about that. I was just thinking, you know, I was reflecting as you were saying about the sequence of old men. Like, there's the old man, there's that image that he paints on the pen cases, right? And it's this pair of the old man who's, you know, cloaked, and the young woman who's offering the flower, and they're separated by the stream. It's almost like that's the template about which every character who appears here is somehow mapped onto.
Right.
And what's kind of neat about it is with the women, and I would like to talk about this more, we start with this idealized, you know, beautiful young woman image, and it ends up being played out in all these different abject kind of ways that we're going to talk about. But for the old man, one of the things that happens is there's the old man in the image on the pen case. Then there's the old man who's the uncle who shows up. Then there's the allusion to the father, who is a twin, we find out, of the uncle. And then the narrator himself says early on, you know, I have a resemblance to my uncle and, you know, and to my father. And he comments on this. And as the narrative goes on, the refrains that we were talking about, where there's certain kinds of phrases that get repeated, one of the ones that gets associated with the old man is this kind of creepy laugh.
Right.
So at the beginning of the book, he says, the old man started to laugh. This is the uncle, right? It was a dry, disturbing laugh that made the hair of your body stand on end. It was a hard, mocking laugh. And then there's a whole bunch of other examples, like a whole bunch of these. For example, in the second part of the narrative, when we have a kind of an embedded narrative, we might talk about the wife's father is said to be laughing a halting, terrifying laugh that made the hair of your body stand on end, right? So there's a whole bunch of these laughs that unify these old men through the book. And then finally, at the very end, in the last paragraph, so many threads are being drawn together. And we hear again about the hunched old man with a scarf wrapped around his head and face. He's holding an earthen jug under his arm, and he laughed a dry, disturbing laugh that made the hair of your body stand on end. And he talks more about it. And then he goes, and you mentioned this in the summary, I went back and looked at myself, and he describes his body as this sort of abject, dead scene. So he himself has kind of gotten drawn into this, the old man identity, and not just as the old man with this sort of terrifying laugh, but the sort of end of life, end of materiality, like this complete abjection. So I almost wonder if we can kind of see the beautiful image of the woman and the old man as like the two ends of a time spectrum, kind of, where with the woman, we start out with this idealized vision, right? And then it extends through. And then we have the sort of abject old man at the end. I don't know. I wonder if that's part of what's going on there.
We do very early on see the woman dead. And the narrator then dismembers her so as to fit her into a suitcase and then buries her.
Yeah. Well, I guess what I meant by the way it starts out is we get all this elevated language of like abstract beauty, almost platonic kind of beauty, right? So she's introduced as a sort of the phrase is used as a celestial angel or a heavenly angel. She's said to be a source of wonder and inspiration. He says, and this I thought was one of the great phrases, he says, one look from her was enough to solve all philosophical problems. Right? I mean, this is like in the first, you know, 12 pages or so. But then, as you said, we move into this increasingly horrifying scene where the body turns out to be dead, and he has this strange encounter with it where he's drawing her, and he can get the drawing almost right. He's drawing through the whole night, except he can't quite get the eyes right. And he's like, and I don't know about you, I'm reading the book at this point. I'm like, oh God, you know, don't do it. You know? But then she seems to momentarily come to life just for a moment, but it's enough for him to get a look at those beautiful eyes and then capture them in his drawing. So the materiality of her body is like in this strange state in the opening sections of the book, where it's like initially beautiful and remote and almost kind of abstract. She's this you know, it's like, you know, you remember this from like courtly literature, other kinds of like ideas of idealized love that raises you up somehow, right? Even in something like the Symposium, which we read together, this idea of a love as an abstract quality that lifts you up out of yourself. It almost seems like that's a little bit of what's going on at the beginning, but pretty quickly we're dragged down into the material and the abject.
Yeah. There's so many places to go with that.
I know.
All right, here's where I want to go with that. So that moment of having this image that you once had of a beautiful woman who then shows up dead and is sort of ruined in a sense. But then there's one moment sort of at the crack of dawn, the light hits just right on her eyes and she looks more alive than ever. And you're trying to capture that and treasure that one single moment, which passes very quickly. There's that one moment where the physicality becomes perfect and immaculate, or at the very least, sort of deeply sensual.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And this is the amount of sexual erotic fulfillment that he can ever get. He gets it in very small moments of physicality. He spies on his cousin. Is this the same he? Who can say? But, you know, basically the narrator spies on his cousin as a young girl getting changed and for a brief moment gets to see her body completely naked. There's another scene even more sort of vivid about that where he is young and he is sick and he's being attended to by his wet nurse. And one day, the other adults in the room, had paid her, the wet nurse, to stuff her black shriveled nipple like a little penis into my cheek. I wish gangrene had infected her nipples. Now when I saw her nipples, I wanted to throw up. But back then, I would suck out the essence of her being with a voracious appetite, and the heat of our bodies would mingle together. She would fondle me all over, and this is why she now treated me with the presumptions of an unmarried woman.
Mm.
There's a sense of like, this was a childhood erotic moment, formative erotic moment for him, this very brief, unusual moment of contact with her nipple. And while this idea now repulses him, it was incredibly informative at that moment. So it's that, again, that sort of that briefness of sexual possibility for this narrator that then, because it can't be reobtained, I don't know, it doesn't go into why, but it becomes disgusting and abject.
Yeah, that's why I keep coming back to materiality, right? Like, this is a very, like, I know it sounds kind of crazy, but like very sort of Neoplatonic book in some ways, like in the sense that it kind of has this, it has this sense, I think, of the possibilities of apotheosis, of being raised up, you know, of being, you know, of transcendence, right? But continuously, just as you're on the threshold of that, it's dragged down to this sort of abject materiality. And, you know, the scene you were describing where he, you know, early on in the book, he's got the young woman there. It turns out that, you know, she's dead. Her eyes, the way he treats the narrator treats the description of her eyes through there, kind of carries us through that oscillation between the possibilities of transcendence, right, which is understood as kind of mediated through vision and immateriality, and then the abject and the gross and the material. So he describes these eyes as radiant globes that draw him into their depths. He just says, as much as the human mind can conceive, this seductive mirror drew my entire being toward itself. Her eyes were intoxicating, unearthly. Right? So there's this kind of drawing up, right? The eyes are like two black diamonds dropped in tears. In her black eyes, I found the eternal night and impenetrable darkness I was looking for and plunged into their horrifying, intoxicating blackness. Right, you know what I mean? It's like that's like this tipping point, right? It should be radiance and light, and like if it was the end of Dante's Paradiso, that's what it would be, right? It would be like this blinding light, right? But instead, what it is horrifying, intoxicating blackness, and that same oscillation happens in the moment you identified where he's as close as he can come to some kind of erotic union. It's again mediated through vision, right? I needed to see these eyes again, right? She had come to life. Her immeasurably open and surprised eyes, eyes that brimmed with the luster of life but flowed with an unhealthy light, her afflicted scolding eyes slowly opened and stared at my face. It was the first time she had noticed me. She looked at me, and then her eyes closed again. So it's like a mutual gaze, right? But like the tipping point, right? It's mutual and not, right? It like breaks almost immediately and plunges into that disgusting materiality again.
Yeah.
So weird.
Yeah, that's an interesting point you bring up about the sort of dark apotheosis that he's aiming for, this desire to be to become nothing, to be absolutely annihilated, which he talks about explicitly at a few points in the book, as you read in the opening, where his true wish is to be completely annihilated, and that if he can't be completely annihilated, that his atoms could be kept from the vulgar, that could be kept from the things that made this materiality so unpleasant. But I will say that it's not just Vision, right? Like, we have the scene with the nurse, which is very tactile, and there's a repeated exploration of the taste of lips.
Yeah, I found that really interesting, too. I was noticing the ways in which not just the whole body, but body parts get a lot of attention. I mean, it happens first when he dismembers her body into parts to get it into the suitcase so he can go get rid of it. But also, like, the eyes, which I was describing, and then lips also come in for a lot of attention.
Yes. Again and again, we get variations on a phrase about her mouth had a bitter, acrid taste like the butt end of a cucumber. Sometimes it's, what is it, mellow? Or there's a few other adjectives that can end up in the mix that can sometimes soften that if he's feeling particularly nice about her, I suppose, in that particular moment. But that is usually at the bitter, acrid butt end of a cucumber taste of lips, which is a marvelously specific phrase. I know exactly what taste we're talking about there. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And he uses this to describe the woman, you know, in the opening part of the book. He also uses it to describe his wife, her body, when his mouth is by her legs and he tastes that. And he says that, uses that same phrase, acrid and bitter like the butt end of a cucumber. And he uses it again also another time in this very odd scene with the wife's younger brother.
Yes.
He says, this is sort of a longer passage, but I'll just read a couple sentences of it. His lips were like his father's lips, but the thing that I found hateful in his father, I found attractive in him, as if his half-open lips had just separated from a long, passionate kiss. I kissed his half-open mouth, which were like my wife's lips. His lips taste acrid, bitter like the butt end of a cucumber. Like, there's a lot going on there, right?
Yes. So he is, at that point, sort of talking with the younger brother of the sister, who is, I'm not sure how old he's supposed to be there, but not far into puberty by the description of things, if even that old, and just plants a big kiss on his half-open mouth, no warning, and finds them to be very comparable to his wife slash this alluring woman, this sort of figure of the alluring woman's lips, which he's found, you know, other parts of this boy to be very similar to. You know, he has the same calves as my wife and the same movements as my wife. But, you know, he decides, well, since my wife won't let me kiss her, I will kiss this boy to get the next best thing, I suppose. And the wife is already sort of the next best thing to her mother, the wet nurse, but that's another story. It's an interesting moment. It's an interesting moment also because so far, gender, as we typically understand it, has been pretty strict in this book, that the men are all the old man and the women are all the young, alluring woman from the painting. But here, childhood changes that rule a bit because this young boy counts in the women category, or it falls under that archetype anyways.
Yes and no, right? Because he does, but then one of the things that I find so striking here is his lips were like his father's lips, and also his mouth, right, is just like my wife's lips. So it's like there's this, again, it's a glitch in the matrix, right? It's like this repetition that kind of dislodges what's happening in this really interesting way. So it's like you said, I think you're absolutely right. It's mapped onto the template of desire for the wife, but something else too is present there.
Yeah, there is more to him than just being another copy of the archetype of the woman that keeps reappearing. It's interesting. It's also interesting that, you know, we've been introduced to many different variations of the men and the women, including the narrator, and only one character in the book gets a name.
Mm-hmm. His mother.
His mother.
Who is it? Is it an odd character who fits in very strangely into the constellation of others?
Yeah, she is. I mean, broadly speaking, she's under that female archetype, but she also seems to diverge from it in interesting ways, or at least her story and seemingly her personality is perhaps the most specific of anyone's in the book, I thought.
Mm-hmm. At one point, he sort of pauses to tell the story about his parents, and he gives basically the version that he heard from his wet nurse. And he says this, "She told me that my father and uncle were twin brothers. They looked identical. They acted the same. Even their voices sounded the same, to the point that it was difficult to tell them apart." And then there's a whole story that flows out from this that involves the two brothers going to India, where they're doing kind of an import-export business, selling goods of different sorts. And after a while, he says, "My father fell in love with a virgin, Bugam Dasi, who was a temple dancer of Lingam Puja. Her job was to dance in front of the great statue of Lingam and attend to it. She was a warm-blooded girl with olive skin, lemon breasts, large slanted eyes, and thin connecting eyebrows with a red dot in the middle." And then there's a very rich, quite beautiful passage that describes her dancing, the way she's dressed. He says, "With elegant swaying and seductive gestures, sacred movements, Bugam Dasi would unfurl her petals and open like a bud, send a shudder along her shoulders and down her arms, then bend low and draw in her petals again. I can just imagine what effect these movements would have had on my father." I mean, it's a long, really kind of hypnotic passage. So she's attractive and alluring in a way that to some extent maps onto what we've seen, but she also seems different. She's part of like South Asian culture, so broadly part of like the same cultural ambit, but she's from South Asia. She's at the temple dedicated to Lingam Puja, so it's Hindu observance, right? It's a very different kind of cultural setting in some ways. So I don't want to use the word exotic, but she's not from the same world that his father and uncle are from.
Right. Although the cousin is specifically marked as exotic, and her family, they're all repeatedly described as being Turkmen and having notable racialized characteristics that he goes over. So that's kind of interesting. What I found interesting about the mother's story is that so she's a temple dancer, and her temple dancing is very erotic for the father in particular. And she decides to leave the temple. She gets kicked out of the temple, I suppose. And she decides to stay with the father, at least for a while. And so you get a kind of fall narrative, right? Like she is doing this holy role, and then it becomes a very secular role. And I when I was reading it, I was sort of developing a theory that this is a kind of an originary point for the understanding of this archetype, of which has always been carrying this sort of, you know, high ideal and disgusting sort of material reality, you know, Madonna horror complex kind of thing going on, but different. But that, you know, this is, again, somebody who was doing this beautiful erotic thing within a holy context that then leaves it to a more base and secular context. And our narrator is the outcome of that decision.
Yeah, I think that's right. She's like uniquely here, like you said, she's uniquely has a name, Bugam Dasi, but also she's kind of a outlier or a survivor, right? There's this elaborate ritual competition that takes place where the father and the uncle are both set against a cobra, and one of them comes out, but because they're twins, it's never possible to know for sure who survived the trial. He says, "My father or my uncle." But the person who comes out looks like an old man damaged by what he's seen. Again, he's become the archetype of the old man through that kind of trial. But interestingly, Bugam Dasi kind of survives and, you know, leaves them behind in a way. "My wet nurse said that when they were saying goodbye, my mother gave a flask of wine to my aunt. It was wine mixed with the venom of the cobra. What better thing could Bugam Dasi have left as a keepsake for her child? This was the same venom that had killed my father. Now I realize what a valuable gift she had given me." So that goes back to the beginning, you know, that wine that we saw in the opening pages. And then he asks this question, which I think is so powerful. He says, "Is my mother still alive? Maybe right now, as I am writing, she is in a faraway city in India, twisting and swaying like a snake as she dances in torchlight, surrounded by curious women and children and naked men, with my uncle and his white hair couching next to the scene and watching." And then he goes back to the narrative. In any case, he goes back to the and so she's still kind of out there in some sense. And in that respect, she really lies apart from this, you know, the template or the archetype of the beautiful woman who is doomed, who descends into decay and materiality and so on. Like, she kind of perseveres in her dance.
Yeah.
Which is really cool.
So are you reading that as the mother, the mother, the absent mother, right? Again, figure of desire, et cetera. being out there, but inaccessible to our narrator.
Like eternally dancing, kind of, right?
Yeah. Do you see that as a lack from the narrator's point of view, or as a possibility for escaping this repeated narrative? Like she's breaking free of the duplications.
I don't know. It's a really good question. I do think she stands apart in some way. Like, you know, you were saying before, she has a name and that separates her. She's attached to the Lingam Puja, you know, to the prayer at that temple. Her dance is itself a form of worship, right? So she gives birth, right, to the child, and she is able to sort of deploy the cobra's venom, right? But she's not dragged down. She's not destroyed by this encounter. She's like almost like a well or something like that, like a source of things. I don't know. I don't know that she represents any kind of hopefulness or possible path for the narrator. I don't think she does, but she stands apart somehow in a way that's very different from the idealized female figure we see in the opening pages.
Yeah. Well, I mean, maybe I wasn't even necessarily thinking of, you know, for the narrator, but maybe just for the reader.
Mm.
This idea that there is some anchor point to something that is outside of these opium-induced repetitions that keep reverberating and creating this wonderfully claustrophobic effect when you're reading the book, if that is just one little tendril of escape.
Well, one of the things I found myself wondering about is wanting to know a little bit more about Sadegh Hidayat's interest in early Iranian culture. I mentioned already he had learned Pahlavi language. I know he spent time studying historical Zoroastrianism. He spent a couple of years in Mumbai. Like, he must have been quite interested in, I guess, ritual practice and understanding something about this. I'd be really curious to read some of his other writings and see if that casts a light on what kind of role Bogam Dasi is playing in the book.
So we've made it this far in talking about the book. We still haven't talked about our friendly blind owl who you promised me in this animal fable that was going to be really pleasant.
I found it really enigmatic. Like, there's a passage quite near the end of the book that is clearly pointing us toward the title phrase. He describes his shadow on the wall. He says, "My shadow on the wall was more vibrant, more defined, more real than my true self. Apparently, the old oddments guy, the butcher, Nana June, and my slut wife," he says, "had all been my shadows at some point, shadows among whom I was imprisoned. At that moment," he says, "I looked like an owl, but my cries were knotted in my throat and I spat them out like bloody phlegm. Maybe the owl also had an ailment that made him think like me. My shadow on the wall looked just like an owl, bent over and reading all my writings closely." So the blind owl is clearly a figure for the narrator here, and especially the narrator at this culminating point. But I don't know what to make of it. Like, I'm wondering if there's kind of a symbolic context for it that, like, there are layers that I might not be fully getting. What did you make of it?
I had a similar feeling to it. It's the final image that we're given that's new, right? I mean, we get more images in the course of it, but they're reflections of other things that we've seen talked about. And even though looking like an owl is in the style of a reflection, right? It's him seeing himself and then looking like an owl. But that's not echoed anywhere else in the text except at this very end moment. And therefore, I didn't feel confident into how to put it together with the rest of the repeated motifs. So I'm not sure. This is a nice moment, but I'm not sure what to do with it.
Yeah. No, it's a bird of night. I think it's typically seen as a bird of bad omen, a bird of bad luck. I think that's right. But I don't know what to make more of it. So that's something maybe we'd have to learn more to make sense of it.
Yeah. I don't want or need this book to give up all its secrets.
Yeah.
And that image of an owl that cannot properly make a sound, that, you know, all its cries were knotted in my throat and I spout them out like bloody phlegm, you know, that made sense. And correct me if I'm wrong, the owl in that passage isn't described as being blind, right?
Not that I see.
Well, so yeah, there are still some mysteries at the end of the book. I mean, there are a lot of mysteries.
Well, it's a very shadowy book, right? I mean, that's part of what gives it its effect, right? It's kind of emotional, or almost, I don't know if scary is the right word, but this feeling of dread. It creates a feeling of dread in you as you read it, right? I mean, it's totally bearable because it's absorbing and enchanting at the same time. But the shadowiness of it, I think, really produces that feeling.
Well, let's talk about that a bit more. Let's talk about that feeling that it produces. This is, I think, the closest thing we've come to reading a horror book. I guess Frankenstein is considered a horror book as well, but this certainly seems like it's doing a lot more horror stuff than Frankenstein is, even if I'm not 100% sure I would call this straight up horror.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't think I would call it like horror either in terms of genre, but it's definitely creating that kind of impact on the reader that we associate with the horror genre. And as I mentioned earlier, one of the writers that like it really pushed my Poe button, you know, because like I said, I read a lot of Poe, love Poe. One of the things I noticed was that there's this these descriptions of the materiality of the body, of the dead body, of decay, of the startling nature of the eye that seems to be open when a moment ago it was closed. There's a bunch of moments in Poe that, you know, connect to that kind of feeling. Stories that a lot of people will be familiar with, like The Telltale Heart or The Black Cat, you know, The Cask of Amontillado, right? Those are ones that'll give you that kind of feeling, right? But there's one slightly less well-known story by Poe that I'm very fond of. It's particularly creepy and horrible. Definitely read it if you haven't read it before. It's called Bernice.
I have not read this one before.
Totally read it. And it's not very long. It's very captivating. And it's also got this weird kind of redoubled family relations kind of thing going on. And there's, I mean, I just want to read this one passage from Blind Owl that I think could be juxtaposed really neatly with Bernice. I mean, if you will indulge me. He says this. He says, "By this point, I was beside myself. I felt like I had known her name before. The glow in her eyes, her smell, her complexion, her movement, it all seemed familiar to me. It was like getting a glimpse of a previous life where my soul neighbored hers. We were of the same origin, built from the same substance. We must have been united. And I must have to be close to her in this life." And so this is the narrator of Blind Owl describing his relation with the girl in the opening pages. He says, "There was an invisible ray that emanated from our bodies and drew us together." He says, "In this degenerate world, I wanted her love or no love at all." So now Poe and Bernice, I mean, it's not that it's word for word, but this vibe of relation is definitely there. So this is from Poe. He says, "Bernice and I were cousins and we grew up together in my paternal halls. Yet differently we grew, I ill of health and buried in gloom, she agile, graceful, and overflowing with energy. Hers the ramble on the hillside, mine the studies of the cloister." He goes on a bit. "Bernice, I call upon her name, Bernice. And from the gray ruins of memory, a thousand tumultuous recollections are startled at the sound. Vividly is her image before me now." And it goes on, there's descriptions of her beauty and so on. And needless to say, it ends really, really badly. And I'll just read a couple of lines near the end. "There came a light tap at the library door, and pale as the tenant of a tomb, a menial entered upon tiptoe. His looks were wild with terror. He spoke some broken sentences. He told of a wild cry disturbing the silence of the night, of the gathering together of the household, of a search in the direction of a sound. He whispered to me of a violated grave, of a disfigured body enshrouded, yet still breathing, still palpitating, still alive. He pointed to my garments. They were muddy and clotted with gore." It goes on. So it's not the same at all, but the vibe is very, there's a real relationship there, I thought, or at least I felt it. Creepy, but incredibly, incredibly fun. Also,
incredibly fun. Well, you know, in a certain sense of fun, absolutely. I'm curious whether Poe, who I've only read a bit of, whether Poe uses some of those techniques of repetition to induce that kind of state that we see in Blind Owl,
like these repeated phrases. Absolutely not. I mean, like I don't think so. I've read a lot of Poe. Like that quality that the love and attraction and then abject materiality coming right on the heels of it, and then these weird family relations, that's something that I really feel in Poe. But this other quality we were talking about in Blind Owl, that these almost quasi-refrains where an image or a phrase or something comes back and back again, I've never seen that anywhere else. The only, like we were talking about earlier, the only analogy I can draw is long narrative poetry where you get that kind of, you know, like I said, refrain-like quality or a particular phrase that comes back again and again. Like, I don't know, like in Spenser's Fairy Queen or something like that. And there's examples in Persian and I think maybe also Arabic literature that might be worth thinking about in this context. So this is a whole other dimension, I think, of what Hedayat is bringing in terms of literary traditions in this book.
Yeah, and I have to say, like, that's the thing that I got most excited about when I was reading this.
Oh, yeah, it's so neat.
I'm not a reader of horror as a genre. I'm not a watcher of horror movies, generally speaking. But I am really interested in the kinds of effects that extreme forms of writing or unusual forms of writing can create on you, you know, psychological effects even. And that's part of what was going on here, that very delicate, sometimes repetition of phrases with slight variations throughout them. And the way that that unsettled your reading, your sense of like what was going on, how firm you were in the text, was delightful for me. And I mean, delightful for a certain sense of delight, because of course it's also very upsetting and stomach churning in its own way, more than perhaps the descriptions of, you know, hacking apart a corpse and burying it inside a suitcase, inside a grave, etc. Like, that's one thing, that's one side of palpable upset and disgust. But that subtle thing that just the use of repetition and carefully constructed language can do, that's exciting and new, and I'm here for it.
Yeah, no, I totally share your feelings about that. Like, I enjoy reading horror, but I don't like watching horror movies. Like, I find that too out of my control, too unsettling. And one of the things that happens in the book is these repetitions you were just describing create this sense of, I don't know what to call it, not orderliness, that's the wrong word, but almost like the quality that there's a kind of it's a labyrinth or a set of puzzles that you can find your way through, and everything kind of fits. Like, you may not solve it all, but you have the sense that it all fits somewhere. And there's this really neat emblematic moment that I think kind of captures it. Remember, we were talking before about he cuts up the body and he puts it in the suitcase and he has to get rid of it, and the old man porter takes him, right? And he when he gets to the place that he's going to bury it, there's a hole that's been dug, and he says, "I carefully lowered the suitcase into the ditch. It was exactly the size of the suitcase, not a hairbreadth's difference. But I wanted to look inside one last time." I'm like, of course you do.
Yeah.
Anyway, and then he opens it, and then he closes it again, buries it. I had brought some of the purple scentless water lilies and arranged them on the dirt. Then I scattered some rocks and pebbles so that no one would ever be able to find the grave. So the idea that there's the grave, and the grave fits exactly the suitcase, you know, it matches up perfectly. I feel like that just really emblematizes, in some sense, like, how this book works. It's horror and materiality and abjectness, and it's all overflowing, like, kind of grossness, and yet it just fits perfectly in the grave.
It's like, do you know the Junji Ito comic?
No.
So Junji Ito is a manga drawer and author from Japan. He's really interesting. He's done a version of Frankenstein, which I have on my shelf and keep meaning to read. It's really great, really gruesome stuff, but he has a very famous scene where, I'm not going to go into the whole thing, but there's a man, he's climbing into a hole that is shaped like a human body, and he says, "It was made for me, this is my hole." And that's the creepiness of it, right? They all find their holes that are fitting perfectly for them and are compelled to go back home, so to speak.
Oh, that's really creepy.
Yeah. That book is called The Enigma of Amigara Fault, and it's worth checking out.
Maybe one day.
That is our first episode officially for 2023, our New Year, New Perspectives episode. And I have to say, I've been looking over the numbers, looking over the data, crunching some spreadsheets. This is the 9th book in a row that we've done that's from the 20th century.
That's a lot of 20th century.
That is a lot of 20th century, perhaps a bit.
Perhaps too much.
Perhaps a bit too much for us, for this little humble show. I think it's time that we do something a little bit older. And so next time we are going to be looking at the Epic of Gilgamesh.
That's considerably older.
Significantly older. It's one of the oldest things I could find. We'll be looking at that. Have you read the Epic of Gilgamesh before?
I haven't. I had read a couple excerpts at one point when I was thinking about including it in a literary survey class I was doing, but I didn't. So actually, it'll be really great to spend some time with it together.
I read it a long time ago when I was in undergrad and loved it quite a lot, and have since learned that the translation that I read and enjoyed is no longer considered reliable, but did get a lot of people excited about it. So there'll be some really interesting things to talk about with translation of texts and how we read very, very old texts that seem quite far from our traditions of reading.
Well, one of the reasons the translations have been changing is because they found more bits, right, in the last few decades.
That's one of the reasons, but we'll talk about some of the other reasons next time. But until then, if you'd like to get in touch with us, you can email us at spouter@megaphonic.fm, or we're on Twitter @thespouter. We'd love to hear from you. Show notes with links for things that we've mentioned in this episode will be at megaphonic.fm/spouter/64. And the Spouter Inn is one of the fancy little podcasts over at Megaphonic FM. So, until next time.
See you again at the Spouter Inn.